We come now to the final session of our conference. We hope to use this session to summarize and knit together some of the themes that many of you have brought and have shared with us in what I believe, in Justice Lange's term, has been a very noisy conference. I'd like to start, I'm going to refer to one of the speakers. Many of you will not remember him. This was Elder Henry Eyring, who was the first speaker at the General Conference. And something's gone wrong with this little earphone thing, so I've got to take it out. It's, sorry. Doesn't matter if you don't remember him. I want to say something about something I learned from him a long time ago. Before he became a church leader, he was a very prominent business management expert. He had got a doctorate at Harvard and taught at Stanford and done a lot of other things. But I learned from him once that there is empirical evidence that unless you write down action items at the end of a conference, practical results are unlikely to follow. So, with that in mind, you have two pages in front of you, I believe. Now, the instructions are you tear these apart, two pieces. One you're going to leave with us, but one you can take with you following this session. And would appreciate it, I suppose you can give confidential or anonymous feedback if you'd like to. It helps us to know who these come from. But I'm going to read through the first page and hope that you will just fill that out as we go along. The form is in English, but I realize we've got several other languages here. But I think it's worth taking just a few minutes of everyone's time to fill this out. So it's a symposium evaluation. And at the top, there is a little set of boxes. And if the term that's close to the words is excellent, then goes good, fair, poor. And so think about these as I'm going to read off these categories. And I'm hoping that you can follow in different languages and just make check marks as appropriate. So, transportation, excellent, good, fair, poor. Hotel, hosting, meals, the Deseret Village, that's the pioneer village that some of you were able to go to. You haven't been to the Humanitarian Center yet, so you'll have to hold on that one. Interpretation. Conference facilities, and then the conference theme or content. Then just some brief questions. Question number one, comments on any of the above or general impressions of the symposium. Number two, comments on the symposium theme, panels, or sessions. Three, which activities were most meaningful to you? Four, what is the most important insight you gained from the symposium? Fifth, do you plan to take any specific actions as a result of the time here? You may not be able to fill all those out instantly, but hopefully you know what they are. And that is ultimately, we'll collect that at the end of the session. And the other one is just if you have further suggestions to us, please feel free to send them or take notes of things you would like to do. Now, there is one very practical thing for you, for the delegates. I'd like you to write at the top of this page, put luggage tags on my luggage when I pack. Let me repeat. put my luggage tags on my luggage when I pack. Now, to be clear, when in your packets you received some luggage tags, they have different colors. If you don't know about them, check with the concierge desk. But what will happen tomorrow, you will be checking out of the hotel here. We'll transport everyone to Salt Lake. Some people will be going on airplanes tomorrow. Some will be at hotels. The color coding is very important if you want your luggage to be where you are at the end of the day tomorrow. So, again, put my luggage tags on my luggage when I pack. Okay? With those preliminaries, one of the things I want to do at this point in the conference is just to say several words of thanks. We're certainly thankful to all of you for coming. I know from personal experience how far some of you have come, and I know that it's not easy. You leave families and others behind. You have desks that are accumulating work while you're gone, so you'll have more to do when you get back. And we know how much of a sacrifice it is for you, each of you, to be here. And we also know how much we have benefited from your presence here, and that this benefit will go on for a long time. There are also many others who have played a key role in bringing this conference about. First of all, I want to express thanks to our student volunteers, many of whom are even now scurrying around, taking care of various last-minute details. I owe particular thanks to the executive committee, who have done so much to make things flow smoothly. You've seen these students as they have worked with you and helped you directly. What you haven't seen is the midnight hours and the weeks before that many of them have spent. I just want to give thanks to them. I think we should applaud. I just don't know if they all hear that. Second, we've had a remarkable hosting group this year. The committee has been led by Jim and Bonnie Pollock. They should stand and wave or something, but they've done a wonderful job of involving many others. Many of these are members of our International Advisory Council. They've come from distant cities to participate in the program. Please join me in thanking them for what they have done. There are many that deserve special thanks. Matt Imbler is the person who's been taking pictures, the platform picture, the pictures when you arrived that you've now got as the directory of the conference. Lori Anderson, whom you haven't seen, but who helped arrange all your travel. Special thanks to Brad Lindsay and Fabio Sajibin, and their crew of 35 translators. I think we owe special thanks to them and also to Church AV. There is another team headed by John Moran and Darren Brown who have helped make the communications, some of the internet facilities, and all of those things, as well as Vance Everett here at the law school. I'd also like to thank Bill Atkin. I don't see him here right now. I may be missing him, but he's Associate General Counsel for International Affairs for the LDS Church, who has been helpful in countless ways. Several other people here. Bob Smith, our Managing Director of the Center, Brett Scharfs, Elizabeth Sewell, and Gary Doxey, Associate Directors, Dave Kirkham and Scott Isaacson as Senior Fellows and Area Advisors, especially new this year, Don Luthayer and Gayla Sorensen, who have done so much with the web introductions. And they also were tour guides on the buses on Sunday, as I recall. A new claim to fame for them. Shally Ehlers and Molly Hewish are secretaries. I should tell you that Shally is getting married in about 3 days, and she's been here night and day, so we hope her mother's got the wedding prepared. And then Christine Scott, who's our head of publications, but is really our head of conference logistics, and of course Deborah Wright, who has done so much to make everything possible. So if you could join in. Okay, in the time we have left this afternoon, we'll divide this in two parts. First, we're going to have a concluding discussion on the theme of the conference, that is how we can better connect communities of discourse on freedom of religion or belief. And then in the concluding moments, I'll say a few words by way of summary of the conference. It's my pleasure to introduce this final discussion. To introduce President Michael K. Young, who is president of the University of Utah. Along with Cliff Wallace, he holds the record, I think, of being at every one of our conferences thus far. It's difficult for him as a university president, but we're delighted that he can be here. It's particularly appropriate that he would talk to us on this theme, because I think over the course of his career, he has been involved on virtually every side of the issues that we are talking about. Following his student days at Harvard, where I first got to know him, he clerked on the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts for Justice Kaplan, and then on the Supreme Court of the United States for Justice William Rehnquist. Following that, he headed a program in Japanese law at Columbia University Law School, and thereafter he was named Dean of the George Washington University Law School. In the middle, somewhere there, late 80s, early 90s, he worked in the State Department under the first Bush administration. He had a number of very interesting responsibilities, one of which was supervising the legal side of the reunification of Germany. After he had been named dean of the George Washington University Law School, he was also named to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. We had the executive director of that body here yesterday. Mike, in the early years, was either the vice chair or the chair, I think in alternating years, for about 5 years of that body, so he has experience both within the U.S. State Department and the U.S. Commission, has extensive experience in academia. While he was at Columbia, he was one of the faculty supervisors for a law and religion program there. He's had extensive contacts with the NGO community, and he is someone who thus brings perspective on many of the areas that we've been talking about. So let me not take more time and introduce Mike.
It is a great honor to be here with you at this conference. I am particularly honored, as I am on enough years that I can be very grateful for it, to share the podium with Cole Durham. I think there are few people in the world who have done more to enable us to think about religious liberties, to think about the relationship between government controls, appropriate levels of government controls, and faith-based organizations than Cole has. He brings a human perspective, but also a keen intellectual approach that has left me in awe at every conference I've ever attended. So, Cole, it's always an honor to be here with you. Thank you. I am pleased to be here for a few minutes to share with you some experiences. I do this with a little bit of hesitation because I look out on this audience and I realize what extraordinary expertise is here in this room. And so therefore I start with a bit of a confession. It's, I think, appropriate to confess in a religious conference, I hope. But I will be speaking today largely from personal observation and personal experience to try and put in a little bit of context some of these experiences that I've had in which I've had opportunity to see the interaction between faith-based organizations, academic organizations, governments, both within government and between governments, that has given me a little bit of a sense, I think, of how the different organizations may operate. And I will do this more as an example of a case study as opposed to a systematic analysis. There will be many other case studies, to be sure, and many other analyses that are possible. But I do this from a perspective of having watched this, as Cole suggested, from a variety of different positions for almost 25 years. I also add, by way of a confession, that this will have a relatively American-centric, U.S.-centric perspective. And I do that not because I think that is the most important perspective, nor even the most enlightening perspective, but it happens to be the only perspective I really know. So I hope you will forgive me from that as well. I start... perhaps the easiest way for me to think about this and unbundle it a little bit is to start from the perspective of my interaction on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. Now, I know you had the executive director here who may have given you a little bit of perspective, but let me step back a step or two and put this in context. The U.S. Commission was created as part of the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. And the design was essentially to create a body of independent individuals who could advise the State Department and the President on ways in which U.S. foreign policy could be used more robustly to advance the cause of international religious liberty. And let me explain a little bit why that was thought to be necessary, why Congress created that. In the first place, Congress created that in part because Congress always has this suspicion that the executive branch is concerned about American interests, not American values, and that it will sacrifice American values in the interest of American interests. And so Congress will, from time to time, focus on activities going on in which they have a suspicion that the executive branch is not interested in that particular set of values. And that is an interesting perspective because what it suggests is that Congress believes that our policies are better informed, our policies are likely to better advance our interests if they are more infused with American values. And they suspect from time to time that the executive branch is less committed to that proposition. And there are a number of pieces of legislation one can trace that reflect that. You see that in the Jackson-Vanik Amendment that dealt with the immigration of Jews from Russia. You see it in a great deal of the environmental legislation. You see it in lots of different kinds of interaction between the executive branch and the legislative branch. So the commission is created was created in part to be an institutional nag. I don't know how you translate nag, but good luck. To spend time highlighting ways in which the administration was failing and ways in which it should modify its policies to better reflect these policies on a global scale. And so that was it. There were other pieces of this legislation, but that's the piece I really want to focus on mostly. So it was designed as an institution that would gather information, that would analyze that information, suggest appropriate strategy and tactics. And then, while not designed to do this, in fact, when it was operating effectively, also as a vehicle for channeling some pressure onto the administration to make appropriate adjustments in foreign policy in these areas. Now, I start with this as kind of a focal point because it became, for a number of years, and I think it's varied in its effectiveness and varied in the degree to which it did this, but for a number of years, it became one of the centerpieces around which the debate about international religious freedom and what the United States should do about it occurred. Not this sole area of that debate, but certainly a primary institution that mediated that debate in the United States. And consequently, it had deep ingrained patterns of interaction with faith-based organizations, with non-faith-based human rights organizations, the NGOs, with the State Department, with the executive branch, and with Congress itself, and also with academic institutions. And so all the institutions that have been mentioned in some way or another interacted with the commission. It had a relatively small budget, and in many ways, so many of the activities that it was designed to accomplish had actually been undertaken by, and often much better, by other organizations. There were many organizations that gathered information much more extensively. There were many organizations that were capable of mounting larger lobbying efforts. There were not very many organizations, interestingly, that were focused very much on strategy and tactics in this regard. And that became one of the areas in which the commission had some effectiveness. But one of the interesting questions is, as it began to evolve, it also assumed a role of attempting to provide some pressure, particularly onto the State Department and onto the President, to modify policy when it could be modified in ways that would advance the cause of religious liberties around the world. And let me make one thing clear about this. The design was to advance religious liberties not in the peculiar, somewhat idiosyncratic American sense of that concept, but actually the legislation was very specific that it was advancing that that as it was defined in the international human rights treaties to which the vast majority of countries had had signed on. But the question then became is, with respect to the pressure, is on whom and for whom? And here, Congress had a particular strategy in mind. Why was Congress interested in setting up a commission to exert pressure on the executive branch rather than doing it directly? And well, one can imagine a lot of reasons. In the first place, Congress is busy, can't really monitor this specific issue with any intensity or frequency. Secondly, Congress is large and cumbersome and lumbering, and its capacity to actually put that pressure on in specific cases was limited, to be sure. And not all the members of Congress were equally interested. It was easy for all the congressmen, and this, in fact, legislation was passed unanimously by both houses, easy for congresspeople to basically say, I am supportive of the concept of religious liberties and freedom of thought, conscience, and belief. But I'm not particularly interested in thinking about it day to day. I'm not particularly interested in being engaged in it in a particular way. And so by creating a commission, you can basically say, I'm blessing the concept, and now go out and do something about it and leave me alone. And that was much of the congressional attitude to that door. It also had a capacity, oddly enough, to reduce pressure on Congress. Because when faith-based organizations were concerned about their treatment, the solution was often, we'll go talk to the commission. We had countless encounters with faith-based organizations who had been referred to us by congresspeople whom they had first approached. In addition, Congress is not particularly well suited to come up with specific concrete steps and specific strategies. And so by creating a commission that could think about that on a more sustained basis, Congress might be in a position to see that go forward without itself having to commit resources or time or energy to do that. One could go on for other reasons why this was a particular device created by Congress. But in those reasons, one also begins to see how the patterns of interaction are likely to have occurred. And let me talk a little bit about that. One of the first patterns that emerged was the realization that there was an enormous repository of information out there in both the NGOs and the faith-based organizations. The faith-based organizations often had representatives virtually everywhere in many, many different countries. We interacted, for example, extensively with the Catholic Church, with many of the evangelical churches. We interacted with the Baha'is, with a number of different Muslim groups, and the list goes on, because those were sources of enormous information about what was actually going on in the country. And so the first utility of that interaction between the faith-based organizations and the NGOs on the one hand and the commission on the other hand was exchange of information. Very valuable and very powerful, but valuable and powerful only to the extent it was accurate. And there we gradually over time began to discern organizations that tended to have a less firm grasp on the facts, and those organizations that seemed to actually be accurate reporters and honest reporters of what was happening. And in any event, no matter the incident, no matter the law that we were looking at, no matter what was going on in a particular country, it became clear fairly early on that we had to consult a number of different groups with different perspectives to get a relatively fulsome view of what actually happened. But the faith-based organizations also had, particularly the faith-based organizations and the NGOs, had expectations that the commission would champion the cause. And herein derives much of the activity of the commission as it began to be more than an advisory commission and a commission that occasionally worked to provide to apply appropriate levels of pressure. And there it turned out that the appointment process became very, very important. The appointment process was three commissioners appointed by the White House, three by the Senate, and three by the House of Representatives. A great deal of jockeying occurred around who was appointed to the commission because different organizations wanted their representative on the commission to champion their particular cause. At the same time, everyone, at least during my tenure appointed to the commission, had quite a passion for the broad-gauged notions of freedom of thought, conscience, and belief, a relatively high degree of sophistication of the complexities of that, but also every one of the appointees had ties in its own community, in his or her own community. And that became very important because as the commission was operating, it became clear this was a part-time position and it would not last forever. And one's reputation within the community from which one had come would in the end be determined to some degree by how effective that particular community viewed the work of the commission. So those who had been appointed from the NGO perspective and had been active in various human rights organizations were very conscious of how their colleagues in the human rights community were viewing them. Those who appointed, whose primary center of gravity had been in a faith-based organization, were enormously conscious of how their organization would view them in terms of the work that they did. And so the jockeying for position also became very important. And this was true in any government position or quasi-government position dealing with this issue. But the faith-based organizations and NGOs also became powerful because in addition to information, they could provide analysis, they could provide assistance with formulating strategies and tactics, and also because they could marshal political pressure. And so you ended up with this very complicated interaction between the commission and these organizations, with the organization wanting the commission to take a particular position. The organization, the commission may or may not have taken that position, but then in turn, the commission wanted the support of these organizations in terms of applying pressure to the different parts of the federal government in order to see that these strategies and tactics were actually effectuated by the U.S. government at the time. Over time, it became apparent that the power of the commission largely derived out of its relationship with Congress. And that's a a concept, frankly, occasionally lost on even some of the current members of the commission, to be perfectly honest. But we found ourselves effective almost in direct proportion to the extent to which we could get Congress interested in holding hearings, in potentially threatening legislation that would force the executive branch to deal with this and to calm down the congressional concerns. And that became a very important part of how the commission derived. Now, the reason I sort of lay out that pattern is it then suggests a much more fundamental truth, both about organizations of this sort, as well as the faith-based organizations and the NGOs that we worked with. And here's the realization. The realization was that organizations, to some large degree, stake out their position depending where they are in the political spectrum. And I don't mean liberal conservative political spectrum. I mean what their position is in relationship to the levers of governmental power. And let me give you a few examples of that. NGOs, and this was true, I did a lot of environmental work over the course of my career as well. This is true of environmental organizations, animal rights organizations. This seems to be relatively true, which is most of the NGOs look at their capacity to accomplish something and realize that as they are fragmented, that reduces to some degree their capacity to be effective. Dividing and conquering is an enormously powerful technique for disabling the effectiveness of the NGOs. So what we consistently found, what I've seen in so many different areas, is that NGOs in a particular area tend to do one thing that causes another thing. The thing they do is they tend over time to develop a set of alliances. This is very conscious and clear in the case of the environmental movement, less clear but quite profound in the case of much of the human rights movement as well, at least in the United States and to some degree globally as well. That is to say, they decide that there is power in unity, and therefore they will take consistent positions, not disagree with each other, and not undermine each other. That's the source of a certain power. Now, what does that occasion? It tends to occasion relatively extreme positions. You take an extreme position because, to some large measure, you are looking to the lowest common denominator, and the most extreme part of the movement is able to divide the positions you take. There's also a fundraising component to it that you have to be very conscious of. In most cases, if you can solve 85% of a problem, it gets very hard to go out and raise money and say, we've got to solve the remaining 15% of this problem. If, on the other hand, you hold out for a solution to 100% of the problem and are unwilling to compromise, then it is easier to say, this problem is not being solved. This problem is not being solved at all, and therefore, securing the funds necessary to attack this problem becomes easier. Now, what does that all mean? It means there is an inevitable tendency for organizations to be more vocal, to stake out stronger positions in the NGOs, to stake out stronger positions, and to some degree stick to those positions. Even against the possibility of quite what might be viewed objectively as quite satisfactory compromises. Faith-based organizations are somewhat different. And they're different, at least in the experience I had on the commission, in part because there isn't, for the most part, the same capacity to develop unity. And there is not nearly the same level of agreement on the specificity, and therefore, much less inclination to let the extremes define the entire movement. And so you end up with organizations that will be at odds from time to time, both in terms of overall goals and in terms of the ways of achieving those goals. And that becomes something else that you see. So you see an NGO movement, the more secular-based human rights organizations, coming at these problems with a particular perspective that over time tends to coalesce around positions that are somewhat less compromise-oriented and somewhat more extreme and unarguable. You see a much more bifurcated and complex faith-based community interaction with government and quasi-government organizations. And then in this particular case, you then saw the commission, which stood somewhere in between. It had an obligation to propose strategy and tactics. It was itself comprised of people who came from all of these different communities. It interacted with these communities both in terms of interaction based on information and analysis exchange, but also interaction in the sense that the members of the commission actually had their principal homes very often in these different communities. And over time, it gradually then needed to assume a role. The expectation of Congress was that it would assume a role of pressuring the executive branch. But at the same time, the commission also in a position realizing that while it would welcome and appreciate compromise, the normal bargaining tactic in the United States is you have to start a little bit further from where you hope to end up because you know that it will be whittled away. And so the commission itself would adopt positions that necessarily put particular pressure on Congress. One of the great misunderstandings, I think, around the world, it was often thought that the commission, as an arm of the U.S. government, therefore was reflective of U.S. foreign policy, and therefore rather strong statements coming out of the commission were statements that should somehow be taken seriously, and if they were particularly problematic for a foreign government to accept, there was a great deal of people being very upset and anger about that, when in fact what most countries did not realize is that the commission was largely an internal function. It was not. It was only hoping to point the finger at countries to put pressure on the State Department, not necessarily to put pressure on the governments. Now, oddly enough, precisely because the governments began to react so strongly to the attempts that the commission made to pressure the federal government, to pressure the executive branch, those designations by the commission began to take on a certain kind of power that I don't think any of us would have expected. It became almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. Countries were upset because they were upset, and therefore these pronouncements of designations of countries of particular concern and the watch list and things like that began to take on a life that that put a certain kind of pressure on government, foreign governments that certainly I don't think was contemplated by the legislation, and certainly not something we had initially anticipated. But once it became clear countries reacted to that, of course it becomes another tool in the arsenal and another way of pressuring the State Department. Now, how does it pressure the State Department? Well, if the State Department is particularly concerned that a country not be named, then the State Department is under some obligation to work with that country to help rectify the behavior that the commission was particularly unhappy with. So oddly enough, the foreign countries themselves gave the commission more power than I think Congress had actually anticipated the commission would have, and certainly more power than the State Department initially anticipated the commission would have. Let me conclude with just a couple of last thoughts about all this. I talked about the NGOs and the extent to which they have a certain kind of power that derives out of a unity they create and an extremity of position that they're often willing to push. Faith-based organizations also may be differentially powerful. They may be powerful in the context of dealing with governments, number one, to the extent they are honest and accurate about the information they convey. Organizations that became we concluded were less reliable reporters of the facts on the ground eventually became organizations we interacted with much less. Secondly, faith-based organizations were powerful in some large measure to the extent they were not parochial. And that is to say, it's very sort of simple and obvious conclusion that virtually all faith-based organizations, I think the LDS Church may be one exception, but almost all organizations that had effective large-scale information flows and lobbying efforts were, if a majority in one country, they were a minority somewhere else. And their credibility in interacting in the process was colored to some degree by the extent to which they were helpful in the countries in which they were a majority. If a faith-based organization came and complained of treatment in one country, but in fact in another country was perpetrating exactly that same kind of treatment of another faith-based organization, they had a great deal less credibility. And I was surprised at how often that occurred. It always occurred to me that the most powerful way for faith-based organizations to advance their interest was to protect faith-based organizations everywhere around the world, particularly when they had in an individual country the power to do that. And some, to their great credit, did, and some, I think, to their embarrassment, did not. Those that did not ended up gradually, over time, losing capacity to have credibility and to interact in these circumstances. They were a powerful partner, effective lobby, very effective in ensuring a certain kind of commitment to their ideals and their goals when they represented uniformly those ideals and goals wherever they were present. They lost that power to a dramatic degree when that was not the case, when they were in situations where they did not stand up for these principles or where they were in fact complicit with the oppressors. They lost capacity and credibility and opportunity to work effectively to protect their minorities in some other part of the world. So that leads me to the last conclusion, which is, I think, at least one of the implications of the questions on the table today is, can these various sources of dialogue, these various centers of dialogue, including the academy, the governments, quasi-government organizations, NGOs, faith-based organizations, can they come together in a way that creates a true, agreed-upon international movement that is effective? To do so, of course, requires a number of things. One, to be very sensitive to the levers of power that are available and how to use those powers in an effective way. But two, I think consistent with that is that there has to be the development internally within the organizations and externally among the organizations, a capacity to be truly consistent, to be truly protective of these, even when it may not, of these principles, even when it may not be quite as crystal clear that protecting that interest is 100% in the interest of that organization. There is a great opportunity to do this, I believe, organizing around some minimalist principles that encourage governments in all countries, using the power of all the faith-based organizations and the NGOs to advance that on a consistent, coherent basis. I realize there are practical challenges to that, in some cases ideological. And doctrinal problems that may even challenge that. But I do believe that a dialogue that started here at this conference presents the opportunity to think more consistently and coherently about doing something precisely like that, something which I know that all of us who have spent so much of our lives working on these issues, for which we would be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Is this working? Yeah. What we'd like to do now is two things. First, before I forget, and I probably owe similar announcements to many of you, but the Kazakh delegation in their side event showed had a presentation with some other materials that copies are available for those of you to pick up at the concierge desk afterwards. And I suspect that there are many others of you. One of the hard things at this conference is always to choose which of the side events you, not side events, the which of the breakout sessions you go to. So please, if others of you would like us to share things, we do have the web facilities now, and we hope as you get home you'll take chances to look at some of the things that you were not able to participating while you were here. But we have some time now that we'd just like to allow people, first of all, to ask questions of Professor Young, but also if there are, this is a kind of time in the conference, if there are sort of comments that you would like to be able to make to share with the group as a whole. We have a limited amount of time, maybe 15 or 20 minutes that we can do that, but if there are comments or questions, we'd be happy to take them. So the first one is always the most difficult. Yes. Let's see, let's get the microphone is coming over.
Ralph Thompson, USA. Professor Young, Dr. Young, President Young, your last paragraph. Do you see a heartening vector of progress along the lines of organizing and moving forward from all the disparate groups that we've been trying to work together with, you know, from different countries and from the academic, from the NGO, from the faith-based, et cetera, academy? If you look at your vast experience over many years, you and Cole Durham, do you see a trend line in a positive direction? Are things beginning to congeal? What is your sense? I know you to be a good optimist, but how do you see things with optimism tinged with the reality of what you've been working on?
I see an enormously enhanced opportunity. That is to say, if you look at the data from 1990 till now, the last two decades, there has been a dramatic decrease in the number of military conflicts, a dramatic increase in the number of people killed in those conflicts, increase in educational levels, decrease in poverty rates. I mean, I could go through the statistics at great length. It is surprising. We don't sense that from reading the paper, but the changes have been dramatic. If you look in 1970, the number of conflicts in which more than 30,000 people were killed, we've dropped almost 90% from the number of conflicts, and the average number of people killed in a conflict today as opposed to then is about 600. I mean, these really dramatic statistics. So I think there is, oddly, an opportunity for all that we read in the press. The world is a much safer, much better, better educated, better fed place than it was two decades ago. So there is an opportunity out there. I'm not a careful enough student to opine with much authority about whether I see the organizations drawing together in ways that that advance that interest. But I will say, as I read the papers and see the incursions on freedom of thought, conscience, belief, it's hard to say that one has seen a dramatic coming together and agreement on these principles and advancement. The opportunity is there. I don't sense that it has been taken to the extent it is possible to do it right now. There are very hopeful signs. I honestly believe this conference is one of them, and the things that have sort of emerged out of this over the last, how many years, Cole?
Well, 15, 16 years.
15, 16 years. We need to have an anniversary celebration. But I would say it's a small ray of light in what does not seem to me an extraordinarily brighter picture. Cole, you might have a different view. I don't know.
I think the one other thing that I could add, I think we've seen some things that have complicated the picture. There's no doubt that there was a kind of euphoria in the early days after 90, 91, when there was a lot of movement, and then there has been a kind of retrenchment in many of the years since. We're unfortunately seeing polarization on Islamic issues. As much as we'd like to build bridges, it's easier to burn bridges than to build them, and so I mean, I think there are challenges in that area. I think there are tensions between what you could call the secular side of the human rights movement and the religious side that I think we could work on. We've definitely tried to work on them, but there are, the challenges do not seem to go away. We're not anticipating a need to abolish the center soon. That's nice as that went. Yeah.
Other questions, comments? We may be at the end of a long conference in which we've worked people very hard, so leave a few minutes just in case, but well, seeing no one, let me just say a few words by way of conclusion. I think that it is difficult to believe in some ways that it was, it's been 20 years ago this fall, that the borders were open in Hungary, people began to flood out of the then East Germany through Hungary and Austria into Germany. Ultimately, with the opening of the Berlin Wall in November of 89, and a number of changes that really meant monumental political and social change throughout Central and Eastern Europe. But not only there. I mean, it's significant that it's not really exactly a coincidence that the end of apartheid in South Africa came in that central period. We had mentioned this morning of a new constitution in Mexico. That was also a very significant kind of change. In many ways, the world changed in significant ways and opened things up. Now, I remember at the time this was all happening that people said it will take a generation for some of the changes to sink in. And one of the remarkable things is that the people who were born in that year are now in college. In a way, the generational change has already come. And it's hard to say how rapidly those kinds of changes are made. It's a little discouraging. I was thinking as Taysir Mandur was speaking this morning and talking about how a lot of the conflict comes in ages 18 to 35. How much have we done for the people who are now 18? We underestimate how little time we have with each rising generation to inculcate principles of respect and tolerance. Our education systems are imperfect. I think things are happening. I know in the OSCE we've worked on these guiding principles for teaching about religions with the idea that this may help many countries working on those kinds of issues. But we really have so little time, and I think this is one of the problems. It's so much easier for the issues of identity and for sort of marking out conflicts and those kinds of things to take hold than otherwise. I think back over the time we've had together as a conference, and I'm not going to be able to systematically go through sessions. But I remember at the beginning Anastasia Crickley saying, we need to get beyond parallel lines. And also a reminder that the most powerful discriminate the most. She was talking about states. But she also said those most blind are sometimes state agents, educators, even judges. And I think one of the things that a conference like this can do is raise consciousness and help us see our own work. I mean, one of the things that's been very significant over the years about this conference is that we have had a remarkable mix of people coming from the various communities of discourse that we've been talking about in the conference, people who have been influential in academics, in government, in all kinds of areas. And what I know from looking out at you and from watching what other people who have come to this conference have done over the years, there's a remarkable potential for people here to pick up on the potential that President Young just spoke about, that is to find ways to do things that really make a difference. So it's part of what makes this a remarkable opportunity from our perspective is having the opportunity to get to know so many of you who really do make a difference in your countries. I think one of the things we have learned, and one of the things that is new, is there's been a great deal of empirical work done. It's very hard to do empirical work on problems of religious freedom. In some ways, the international reports that the ambassador at large's office in the U.S. State Department has done, they're imperfect. The reports are short. They can't cover everything, but they cover a remarkable amount, and they cover more than was ever available in a systematic way before. And one of the things that's been happening is social scientists, who are always good at dealing with these things, have started analyzing things. And one of the interesting things that's coming out of the empirical work is that religious freedom is more important than people had thought. I won't go into numbers, but there are strong correlations, not at all surprisingly, between religious freedom and other civil and political rights, freedom of speech, freedom of press, and so forth. Those things tend to go hand in hand in constitutions and in countries. It's not surprising that those would correlate. But what's interesting is very strong correlations between religious freedom and per capita income in countries. Very strong correlations between religious freedom and how women and women's per capita income in countries functions. There is data showing that the literacy rates are higher in countries with religious freedom. And it's just, some of these things are correlations, but it appears to be more than just a correlation, because you can look at mechanisms that show why these things would happen. There's very strong evidence that people in religious groups tend to volunteer more or donate more, both to the religious groups themselves, but also to other kinds of causes. And this increment in social capital, which is liberated by religious freedom, pays rich dividends across societies. So it's important that we pay attention to that. We also need to be sure, and this is a line from Justice Lange, he said, we need to be sure that our home countries and home environments are places worthy of the name home. That is, he said, you can't be at home in a world at large unless you have a home to be at home in. He also said that the secular and the sacred must coexist. We need to recognize the sphere which each inhabits and not force one into the sphere of the other. And one of the groups I was able to attend, Bishop Edgehill talked about the importance, which he said, religious liberty thrives where there is a genuine movement from mere tolerance to respect. Religious liberty exists when you can freely propagate your faith without being demonized or vilified, or without demonizing or vilifying the faith of others. And I think that kind of respect is extremely important. One of the things we will do is I think we're impressed this morning as John Taylor was talking about some of the initiatives that are coming on the international front. We'll do what we can, John, to make sure that if people didn't take notes, they'll know that website where additional work can be done. Now, I thought one of the things I might do is just describe a story. Some of you have heard me tell this story before. But I remember a few years ago going to Nigeria. I was speaking at a conference sort of in the middle of Nigeria between the Muslim North and the Christian South. In a city called Jos. And it turned out that in that city, This was a city that had had some violence, and I kind of looked into it. And two or three years earlier, members of a small Christian group were in the process of finding a site and building a church. They located some property that was near a mosque, and they worried that building nearby might cause some tension. So they went to the mosque and talked to the leaders there and asked if they would object to their building. The people of the mosque said no one had ever shown them the respect of asking that question before. They consented to the building, and good neighborly relations ensued. A few years later, when rioting erupted, a group of enraged Muslims from another part of town came charging down the street, carrying torches and intending to burn down the Christian church. When that happens, the neighbors from the mosque across the street came out, stood in the way, and said, "Don't burn down this church. These people are our friends." Now, it seems to me that the fundamental questions we're really asking today boil down to questions about how patterns of neighborliness can be encouraged so that when the fire of intolerance begins to rage, people will come out and say, "Put the fire away. These people are our friends." There are so many things that could have gone wrong in the foregoing story. I'm happy that in this particular story I had heard about it because it was from a Mormon group. But they could have forgotten to go and talk to the neighbors. They might have just sort of filed the papers for zoning and prepared for the usual problems that occur when one religious group is building near another. They could have said, and the people in the mosque could have reacted differently too. They could have said, "We don't want a Christian church so close to us. Find some other property." It was a less known denomination. They might have reacted with, according to fears and stereotypes and bias, and they might have failed to see through the stereotypes to the people that came to their door. They might have said, "We only want traditional groups as our neighbors." Of course, even deeper levels of resentment with history and all kinds of things could have come into play, but fortunately, it was a story that went well. Now, what I'd like to do is just suggest a few things that may make a difference. I might call these technologies of peace. First, we've talked a lot about dialogue in this meeting. I think it's important to find ways to expand room at the dialogue table. I was recently at an event at which some interreligious conflicts in Sri Lanka were being discussed. Interreligious dialogue was suggested as a response. Further, it was suggested that an interreligious council be established to help institutionalize the dialogue. The difficulty was that the traditional religions that had been in Sri Lanka for centuries did not want to make room at the table for relative newcomers who had been in Sri Lanka for a mere 50 years. This, it was feared, would confuse the dialogue. The irony was that from the perspective of the traditional groups, it was exactly the newcomers that were causing the problem, and they were exactly the ones that were not being talked with. And I think one of the things that's vital is finding ways to broaden the dialogue. I recognize, of course, that there are literally thousands of churches or religious groups, and you can't have dialogue tables with 1,000 seats. But I do think when dialogue is being structured, there are ways to make sure that it's not just the large or the traditional that are representing. Having at least some space for some others makes a difference because they have a different perspective. After all, in matters of religious freedom, the ultimate test of success is not how the large groups are treated, but how the weak and powerless are treated. Also, I think we need to remember that there are ways that people can be included even without formal seats. We had, I think it was, well, it was again Justice Lange talking about methods for allowing talk to happen and to go forward. In parts of my career, I've spent working with municipalities and have come to have tremendous respect for hearings. Just allowing people to be heard, taking the time to listen too, and not just make this a sham process, because if you truly listen, you often find solutions or hear problems or think of things that no one just working as a centralized body would see on their own. Things like having an open microphone or just allowing places where people can be heard. My frank opinion is that one of the most important things about this, the entire U.S. Religious Freedom Act, is that there is a low-level official in most U.S. embassies that someone can go and talk to. And it's a simple thing, but it makes a great difference. So a second major point is, as important as dialogue is, what might be called diapraxis is even more important. And this I've learned from people like Tore Lindholm and the Oslo Coalition. One of the really powerful things is not just talking to each other, but there are all kinds of issues about which people have deep concerns. People across all kinds of religious lines, and people learn respect for each other more from working shoulder to shoulder on projects than expounding on doctrine or trying to come to some theological understanding. Not that that isn't also a useful enterprise, but one should not underestimate the importance of diapraxis. A third area where technologies of peace are urgently needed is in the area of religiously offensive speech. Much that needs to be done in this area goes beyond legal to ethical requirements. On the one hand, as some of those have suggested during our meetings here, we need to show respect to others by learning what is sensitive for others. I think one of the powerful lessons of the Danish cartoons is that many of us in the West learned that the Islamic world has sensitivities on issues that are simply not sensitive to us. Most of us in the West would have looked at those cartoons. In fact, a friend told me they had gone through the New Yorker and found all kinds of equivalent Christian cartoons, but that doesn't matter, because in a way, our Muslim brothers and sisters see things through different filters, where pictures have different meanings and where sensitivities are heightened. We need to understand some of those differences. At the same time, we need to be cautious in the response, because too often what's been happening, as many of you would know, even before the Danish cartoon, starting in 1999, Pakistan started, for the Organization of Islamic Conference, started proposing resolutions on defamation of religion. These have evolved over the years, but they've been passed regularly. And starting in 2005, these started coming to the General Assembly. And of course, the idea is a good one, that we should respect each other's religions and so forth. But one of the problems that's been happening is that you get the enforcing legislations in some of the countries. Too often this can be used as a weapon as well as a protection. And what is merely speaking about religion or witnessing one's faith or just speaking can become grounds for incarceration. I think of one concrete example. it's a little disrespectful perhaps, but there was one of the countries, an Islamic country, of course, Indonesia, had passed some legislation on this area. There was a publisher of a news magazine that sort of did an opinion poll, who is most influential as an opinion leader in the country? And it turned out that Muhammad was on the list. Turned out that the publisher of the newspaper was on the list. Unfortunately, he ranked ahead of Muhammad in the survey, and he published this. This did not make people happy, and the editor got 5 years in prison. Well, I mean, the editor may have been a little, should have been a little wiser, perhaps. But the point is, there's a very delicate balance that we're working out, that needs to be worked out here. And on the one hand, there's a great need for sensitivity. On the other hand, there's need to make sure that this is done in a balanced way, so that it's not used as a means to censor opposition and so forth in various countries. This is in the UN right now. It's time of year, so this is a big issue. Fourth area in which we need to forge technologies of peace is the area of enculturation of religious freedom norms. In discussions among our experts during the week, and I can tell you in prior conferences, this is an area in which a lot of attention is paid. How do we get norms that are widely recognized? There are disputes, of course, about universality, but widely recognized. Most of the countries on Earth have ratified and implemented them, and yet we have each rising generation, and I'm afraid to say it's not just the 18 to 35 people that are at fault. I mean, it's a broader problem. How do we get the norms that people pay lip service to become written into people's conduct, written into people's hearts? We have a tremendous amount of evidence now that the philosopher John Locke was right in recognizing that greater social stability is achieved through respecting conscientious differences than through attempting to eliminate dissent and difference. Precisely because conscientious beliefs are so deeply held, people are inclined to fight back when their core beliefs are threatened. Extensive attempts to enforce security can result in less security rather than more. Since 9/11, this has been a recurrent and difficult theme. Long-term security cannot be achieved without implementing religious freedom standards. In this field, it's important to understand that technologies of peace do not require us to abandon or compromise deeply held views. What is required is the humility to recognize that the fact that we believe certain things to be true, or our group, does not authorize us to impose those beliefs on others. Moreover, every major religious tradition has teachings, scriptural passages, or other similar resources that overlap and support the idea of human dignity and the notion that others should be treated with respect. Every tradition needs to find ways to highlight such resources. People with deeply different worldviews, even people holding exclusivist views of truth, can live together in peace if they can make credible to each other their beliefs about their respective obligations, coming from within their respective traditions to respect and protect the rights of others. Perhaps the most important technology of peace is learning how to bring the illumination and inspiration from the high places of our various traditions back to day-to-day life in ways that respect what others believe as they return from the high places of their belief systems. There's a famous passage on the wall near the UN that speaks of beating swords into plowshares. This occurs in the context of a great prophet dreaming of a time when many people would go and say, "Come ye and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord." The passage is found in a book held to be sacred by the three of the world's great religions, and surely can be grasped by others as well. Now, I have to admit, I'm a child of the mountains, and I have actually climbed some of them. I know what it is to climb in the high places. I know what it is to walk along some of the precipices, and I have fear of heights, actually, so when I've done this, my kids won't take me up in the mountains anymore because of this. But so I know what it's like to sort of walk and you watch the footsteps of the people ahead of you. I know what it is to reach the top and to realize that whatever path you have taken to the top, one still remains infinitely beneath the starry heavens above. But if we can take what we can learn from these ascents and share it non-coercively with others, we will find the technologies of peace that we seek and that we need. Thank you.